We live in a world made of lines. Some are drawn in the sand, some in ink, some in blood. Some we cross without thinking, others we're told to never cross. But what if the lines meant to keep us safe are the same ones keeping us from understanding each other? This episode isn't about politics, it's not about sides, it's about something deeper. What do borders really do to us? What are they protecting? What are they dividing? And what happens to nations, to communities, to people, when we let a line become a wall? By the end of this episode, we'll have pulled apart borders from every angle, historical, emotional, and human. And no matter what you believe, you will leave seeing them differently. So stay with me, and let's walk the line. Before there were lines on maps, before there were flags, before there were checkpoints, passports, or the phrase illegal crossing, there was land and people who belonged to it. In this first segment, we journey back not just a few hundred years, but thousands, to the time before the invention of the modern nation state, the time before national borders, when land was not owned, but lived with, when it was divided, but held in common, revered, and understood. For many indigenous cultures, land is not property, it is identity, it is ancestor, it is language, it is home, in the spiritual, physical, and communal sense. Let's begin with in the Pacific Northwest, where the Coast Salish people have lived for at least 10,000 years. Their land span what is today like the US-Canada border, British Columbia on one side, Washington State on the other. But this division is a fiction to them. Their relationship with the land, with the mountains, with the waters, the salmon runs, predates those political definitions by millennia. We don't see land as something that can be divided. Our stories, our songs, our burial groups, they flow through the valleys, across rivers, over what you now call borders, the land who we are. It remembers before those lines were drawn. This belief is not isolated. Across continents, indigenous communities tell similar stories of rivers crossed by generations, of herds that migrated across now closed borders, of kinship networks spanning modern-day nations, from the Sami reindeer herders in North Scandinavia to the Tohono O'odham Nation, sorry if I pronounced that wrong, straddling to the US-Mexico border. The land holds a continuity that political lines cannot erase. But to appreciate this fully, we need to question the very concept of land ownership in Western legal traditions. Land is property, a commodity. It can be bought, sold, and fenced off. This idea is baked into how borders work. They delineate control, sovereignty, taxation, law enforcement. But in many indigenous worldviews, land is not owned. It is shared with all living things, held in trust for future generations. In some languages, there isn't even a word for owning land. The relationship is kinship, not conquest. Borders are a colonial invention. They were imposed to facilitate control, not to reflect the lived realities of people on the ground. When European settlers came to the Americas, they didn't just bring disease and guns, they brought maps, and those maps slowly erased what was already there. Take a step back and think, why is the US-Canada border a straight line in some places? Why does the US-Mexico border cut across deserts that indigenous people had traveled freely across for thousands of years? It wasn't geography, it was negotiation, conquest, and often deliberate disregard for the indigenous nations that already existed there. The land remembers this. This segment isn't just about history, it's about perspective. To understand the damage done by borders today, we must first understand the deep, sacred connection that many indigenous people had with the land, and how little regard colonial governments showed for those relationships when they began carving up the world into nations. In upcoming segments, we'll explore what happened when those arbitrary lines were drawn, But for now, we leave you with this thought. If the land remembers, what stories is it trying to tell us? And are we listening? In the last segment, we explored how Indigenous people have maintained a sacred relationship with the land since time immemorial, a relationship often unacknowledged by modern states. Now we turn to a more specific chapter, the creation of borders, not just as lines on a map, but as acts of erasure. This segment is called Drawn Without Us, and that title is not metaphorical. Borders were not negotiated with Indigenous nations, they were imposed over them. And the consequences of that imposition are still unfolding today. Let's go back to 1783, the Treaty of Paris, which ended the American Revolutionary War. That treaty established the border between British colonies in Canada and the newly formed United States. But there was a problem. It cut through the territories of dozens of Indigenous nations. None of them were at the table. The same happened throughout the 19th century, as borders continued to be drawn through Indigenous lands, from the Oregon Territory to the Northern Great Plains, from the deserts of Arizona to the rainforests of British Columbia. In many cases, borders violated not only spiritual and ancestral territories, but treaties that had been signed and broken. Take the Jay Treaty of 1794. It included a clause of allowing Indigenous people to travel freely across the US-Canada border. But fast forward to today, and Indigenous people often face intense scrutiny, denial of rights, or outright detention at border crossing. The spirit of the treaty is ignored. Or look at the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo in 1848, which ended the US-Mexico War and gave the US half of Mexico's territory. Again, hundreds of Indigenous nations were affected. They were not consulted. These borders didn't just steal land, they divided communities, families, spiritual sites. They criminalized movement that had always been a part of the way of life. And the impacts were not only physical, but also legal. By drawing lines, colonial governments also drew legal boundaries, deciding who would be recognized as Indigenous, where rights would apply, and who had jurisdiction over natural resources. Sometimes an Indigenous nation would be recognized in one country but not another, or a sacred site would end up on the other side of a border, effectively locked away. These stories are not just historical artifacts, they're living realities. Think of what happens when a mother can't cross to the other side of her nation to attend a funeral, when a ceremony must be delayed because the medicine bundle was held up by customs. When an elder without a passport is told she can't cross a border to see her sister, despite having walked those same forests since childhood. This is what happens when borders are drawn without us. So the question is not only do borders protect or divide, the deeper question is, who had a say in those borders to begin with? And perhaps more urgently, what can we do when those borders continue to harm people who've lived with the land the longest? Borders are not abstract. They are not just ink on a map or lines etched by treaties centuries ago. They are fences, barriers, armed checkpoints. They are hours of questioning and searches. They are missed funerals, delayed ceremonies, children separated from their grandparents. In this segment, we're looking at the lived reality of Indigenous communities that find themselves literally divided, not metaphorically, by national borders. These borders, drawn by colonial governments without Indigenous consultation or consent, have become a daily burden for communities that predate them by thousands of years. Let's begin in the Sonoran Desert, which today is called Southern Arizona and North Mexico. Here, the Tohono O'odham Nation has lived since long before the United States or Mexico existed. Their lands span both sides of the border, or rather, the border now cuts through their land. For centuries, members of the nation moved freely to attend ceremonies, visit relatives, gather medicinal parts, and honor sacred sites. But with the rise of strict immigration enforcement, especially in the past few decades, the freedom has disappeared. Now to cross the border legally, Tohono O'odham people must go through customs and immigration, as if they were foreigners entering someone else's land. Many elders don't have the paperwork. Many sacred sites lie on the other side. And sometimes, there is no legal crossing at all. Just a fence, just a wall. The introduction of border walls and surveillance towers has also brought militarization. On what was once a desert where families walked to visit cousins, there are now border patrol trucks, motion sensors, drones, heavily armed agents. Imagine walking into your grandma's house as you've done since you were a child, and now being stopped, interrogated, or even detained. This is not a past injustice, this is present tense, and is not limited to the US-Mexico border. Travel thousands of miles to the Akwesasne Mohawk Nation, a community that spans the provinces of Ontario and Quebec in Canada, and the state of New York in the United States. Here, members of the same family lived in three jurisdictions. To travel a few miles for a birthday party, they might have to go through an international border crossing. But it's more than an inconvenience. It's a disruption of the ceremony, denial of culture, interference with spiritual and political sovereignty. Some Mohawk youth grow up with heightened surveillance and daily questioning simply because they lived in a border-straddling community. They internalize the notion that their mobility is suspicious, that their identity must be checked and rechecked by state authorities. Even funeral processions are sometimes stopped at the border. Imagine a convoy of grieving family members asked to step out of their cars, questioned, delayed, or to reach a burial site they've been using for generations. These are not dramatic exceptions. This is what it means to be indigenous in a divided homeland. Borders are not only interfere with movement, they distort identity. Some indigenous people are not recognized equally on both sides. A person may be recognized as a citizen of a nation in the US but not in Canada, or they may be forced to carry passports even when their community predates both governments. And when they protest this treatment, when they assert their right to move freely on their own land, they are often met not with understanding, but with suspicion, with guns, with bureaucracy, with indifference. Borders are not neutral, they are enforced violently and unevenly, and for indigenous people, they do not merely divide land, they divide worlds. They cut into ceremonies, language, memory, kinship, and spirit. This is what happens when a border gets in the way. Despite the many ways borders have divided and harmed indigenous communities, this is not a story of helplessness. It is a story of resistance, of resilience, of sovereignty reasserted, reclaimed, and reimagined. In this next segment, we look at how indigenous nations refuse to be defined by borders, how they continue to govern, organize, and protect their cultures, regardless of which claims jurisdiction... of which country claims jurisdiction over them. We begin with a truth that often goes unspoken in mainstream discourse. Indigenous nations are sovereign. Their sovereignty does not come from the permission of the US, Canada, Mexico, or any other state. It is inherent, grounded in thousands of years of governance, diplomacy, and law. Despite being divided by national borders, many indigenous nations continue to operate as one people. They conduct cross-border governance meetings. They host ceremonies that bring together members from multiple sides. They educate their youth in their own languages and traditions, not confined by the curriculum of the dominant state. Take the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, sorry if I pronounced it wrong, an alliance of six nations whose territory stretches across what we now call the US-Canada border. For generations, they have issued their own passports. They have challenged border agents when traveling with these documents, asserting their rights as sovereign people, not as Canadians or Americans, but as Haudenosaunee. In 2010, a delegation traveled to the United Nations using the Haudenosaunee passports. They were delayed, questioned, threatened with denial, but they persisted. They refused to let colonial borders rewrite who they are. And they are not alone. In the north, the Inuit have worked across four countries, Canada, the US, Russia, and Greenland, to develop transnational policies rooted in shared culture and ecological knowledge. In the southwest, the Tohono O'odham continue to organize against the construction of border walls on their land. They protect sacred sites from destruction. they mobilized to resist militarization. Across these efforts, one theme is clear. The assertion of indigenous sovereignty does not end at a border, but this assertion often comes at great cost. Indigenous people who challenge border policies may face arrest, travel delays, intimidation, their traditional passports may be confiscated, their ceremonies surveyed, their resistance criminalized, and yet they continue. This is sovereignty without wars. It is not about pretending borders don't exist. It is about refusing to let those borders erase nationhood. It's a radical act in a world so obsessed with division to insist on continuity, on memory, on the legitimacy of your existence, across maps, across languages, across state-imposed lines. This is not merely activism. It's law, it is life, it is governance carried forward despite colonial disruption. And it's growing stronger. In the age of digital communication and indigenous resurgence, more and more nations are connecting across borders, organizing international councils, collaborating on environmental protection, language revitalization, and land stewardship. These borders were drawn to divide, but indigenous sovereignty refuses to be fenced in. In this chapter, we've walked along some difficult edges. We've seen how borders drawn without consent continue to separate indigenous people from their lands, their families, and even parts of themselves. We've heard how sacred traditions are delayed by bureaucracy, how border wars scar landscapes that have held stories for millennia. But now we ask, where do we go from here? This is not just a question for governments. It is a question for everyone who benefits from the systems those governments have built. A question for those of us who live on indigenous land, whether or not we've ever thought about it that way. The future must begin with recognition. We must acknowledge that the existence of a border, whether between the US and Canada, the US and Mexico, or anywhere else, was not a neutral act. It was an imposition, one that continues to have legal, cultural, and spiritual consequences. But recognition is not enough. There must also be restoration. That means honoring treaties, not just in principle, but in policy, reinterpreting immigration and border laws to respect indigenous sovereignty, creating special mobility rights for indigenous people who live in bordering straddling communities. It means restoring land, not just compensating for its loss. It means supporting indigenous government systems, not controlling them. And perhaps most importantly, it means changing the way we think about borders themselves. What if borders were not walls, but bridges? What if we saw borders not as hard lines, but as spaces of shared stewardship, places where the wisdom of indigenous land guardianship could shape how we relate to each other and the earth? That future is not impossible, but it requires unlearning, unsettling, and listening. It requires governments to do something they have rarely done. Step back, make space, respect. And it requires us, all of us, to ask, what do we owe to the land we live on? And what do we owe to those who were here first? Borders will not vanish overnight, but maybe if we start telling the truth about what they've done and listening to those they've harmed, we can begin to imagine a world in which they'd no longer, like, divide us. When we hear the phrase border security, what comes to mind? Maybe it's the image of heavily armed agents standing beneath a flag. Maybe it's the infrared drones watching from the sky. Maybe it's a wall stretching across desert terrain, silhouetted against the setting sun. But beneath all of that imagery is something far more abstract and far more powerful. Fear. Fear is the real architecture of border security. Fear is what makes a wall seem necessary. Fear is what makes surveillance seem acceptable. Fear is what makes cruelty at the border seem like protection. But where does that fear come from? Because if we trace the origins of modern border security, especially in the US, We don't find a long history of real imminent danger. We find something else, a story that was built, a threat that was invented, a set of anxieties that were cultivated, fed, and then weaponized. Let's go back. The US border control wasn't even created until 1924. That's less than 100 years ago. Well, actually, slightly more than 100 years ago, but... And at the time, its job wasn't to defend against terrorists or drug traffickers. It was to enforce racialized immigration laws. One of its earliest targets? Asian immigrants, especially after the Chinese Exclusion Act. But even then, the border wasn't imagined as a high-security zone. It was a porous. Locals crossed it for shopping, for festivals, for family visits. People moved in with relative ease. The violence came not from geography, but from laws that said who was allowed in and who wasn't. It wasn't until the late 20th century that we began to see a shift, a pivot toward treating the southern border as a place of menace, a place of threat, a place that needed to be sealed. The shift wasn't inevitable, it was deliberate. In the 1980s and 1990s, political rhetoric in the US increasingly tied immigration to crime. Candidates ran on platforms that cast undocumented migrants, especially those from Mexico and Central America, as dangerous. Invasion metaphors began to appear in speeches, words like flood, tidal wave, storm. This wasn't just language, it was framing. It primed the public to see migration not as a movement, but as attack. By the time 9/11 happened in 2001, the groundwork had already been laid. Suddenly, the idea of a terrorist slipping across the borders wasn't just a possibility, it was a fear ready to be activated. And politicians, media outlets, and security contractors waited no time, doing exactly that. The Department of Homeland Security was created in direct response to 9/11, and with it came a vast expansion of border enforcement powers. The budget for customs and border protection skyrocketed. Surveillance infrastructure was rolled out across the southern and northern borders. The war on terror and the war on migration became increasingly intertwined. But here's one thing. Almost none of the 9/11 attackers crossed the land border. They came in on visas and overstayed. The actual danger had little to do with the US-Mexico border, but that's where the response landed. Because it was politically useful, because it was radically coded, because fear is easier to sell when it has a visible target. And that fear? It became policy. Suddenly, migration wasn't a humanitarian issue, it was a security issue. Asylum seekers were no longer fleeing danger, they were the danger. Brown bodies, tired from the road, became objects of suspicion. The very language we used began to change. People were no longer called immigrants, they became illegals. They weren't families, they were caravans. Even the act of crossing a border, something that had been a part of a human life for thousands of years, was now criminalized, surveyed, and cast as subversive. And so we arrive at the border we know today, one defined not by actual threat, but by performance of threat. One where every backpack becomes a potential bomb, every mother has a suspect, every child becomes a bargaining chip. The border, in this way, has become less about reality and more its story. A story told again and again, until it starts to feel like truth. And when that story is fair, the border becomes a stage. And we all become its audience. We talk about the border wall as if it's a structure, a line of steel or concrete that keeps some people in, others out. But it's not just a wall, it's a brand, a message, a sales pitch, a campaign banner made of metal and fear. And for decades now, the wall and the idea of securing the border has been one of the most powerful tools in American political theater. It's easy to forget that most of the southern US border already has fencing. In fact, as of today, hundreds of miles are fortified with walls, barriers, the vehicle trenches, and surveillance tech. These aren't abstract plans, they're already built. but when politicians speaking of building the wall, they rarely acknowledge that, because the wall isn't just about geography, it's about projection. Let's take a step back and look at the money. Border enforcement is a multi-billion dollar industry. Between Customs and Border Protection, Immigrations and Custom Enforcement, and Department of Homeland Security contracts, the federal government has spent over $300 billion on border and immigration enforcement since the early 2000s. That money doesn't disappear into the sand, it goes somewhere. It goes to contractors, consultants, tech companies, arms manufacturers, the private prison corporations. This is what many now call the border industrial complex, a network of private firms that profit immensely from the idea that border is dangerous and therefore must be defended with more and more equipment, personnel, and force. Take the wall itself. It's not just one monolithic structure, it's a patchwork of projects, each contrasted out to private construction companies. Each new stretch of wall brings contracts worth tens or even hundreds of millions of dollars, and those contracts are often awarded with little transparency or public oversight. The companies that win these contracts, they're not just building walls. Many of them also build prisons, detention centers, military installations. They are a part of a larger ecosystem of incarceration and control. But the profits don't stop at concrete. The new frontier is surveillance technology, drones, motion sensors, biometric scanners, artificial intelligence software that claims to predict migrant movement, towers that watch the desert night like mechanical sentinels. These tools don't make us safer. There is no clear evidence that they reduce migration. What they do is make people rich and allow governments to claim that they're doing something. Border surveillance companies sponsor security conferences. They lobby legislators. They promise the illusion of total control. And that illusion sells, because the border isn't just a site of enforcement, it's a stage for politicians to act tough, to point a wall and say, look what I built, to stand in front of steel and say, I'm keeping you safe. But safety from what? Let's be honest. The real threats to national well-being, climate collapse, inequality, mass shootings, infrastructure decay, don't come from tired migrants crossing the desert. They come from within. And yet, we spend billions building walls that don't protect us from any of those things. Because the wall isn't meant to protect, it's meant to symbolize control. Control over land, control over people, control over the story we tell ourselves about who belongs and who doesn't. And that symbolism, it's a business. It keeps elections running, it keeps media ratings high, it keeps budgets flowing. It turns fear into policy and policy into profit. And the wall, it keeps growing. Even when it's not being built physically, it expands in our imaginations, in our budgets, in our politics. Because the wall doesn't have to work. It just has to sell. There's a strange thing that happens in borderlands. The further you move from the physical line that divides two countries, the more you realize the border didn't stay put. It followed you. It crept inward, quietly, invisibly, until one day you look around and realize you're not just at the border, you're inside it. In the United States, this phenomenon has a name. It's called the Constitution Free Zone. That's not an exaggeration. That's what civil liberties advocates have called the area within 100 miles of any US border. Why? Because in that massive swath of land, which includes entire cities like San Diego, El Paso, Tucson, Miami, Boston, and even New York, border control agents have expanded search and seizure powers. They can stop vehicles, question people, ask for papers, often without a warrant or probable cause. Let's be clear, that zone includes about two-thirds of the US population. In these places, the presence of border security isn't confined to a checkpoint, it's everywhere. Unmarked vehicles on highways, helicopters flying over neighborhoods, surveillance towers peeking over ridgelines, and inland checkpoints, some over 50 miles from a border, where agents stop vehicles at random and ask, are you a US citizen? Now, if you've never been stopped, it might sound minor. Just a question, right? Just routine security, but for millions of people who live near the southern border, especially Black, Brown, Indigenous, and documented community, and undocumented communities, sorry, this question isn't neutral. It's invasive. It's repeated. It's radicalized. It's racialized, sorry. And it's backed by the threat of detention, harassment, or worse. Imagine driving to school and being stopped. Imagine commuting to work and being asked to prove your right to exist in the place where you've always called your home. Imagine a uniformed agent peering into your car, scanning your face, reaching for their weapon if you hesitate. This isn't a border. It's a regime of suspicion, and it shapes daily life. A US citizen named Sergio once told a reporter that even though he was born and raised in Texas, he carries his birth certificate with him every time he drives more than 30 miles from his home. He's been stopped too many times, pulled over, asked to prove who he is. He's Mexican-American. His name and his skin makes him a suspect. Meanwhile, white residents in the same area report breezing through checkpoints without a glance. This is not security, this is profiling, this is racialized border logic made physical, one that doesn't just live on maps, but inside bodies. It's also not just happening in the Southwest. Up north, along the US-Canada border, indigenous communities like the Akwesasne Mohawk Nation, whose territory straddles both countries, are subjected to constant monitoring. People crossing from one part of their own homeland to another are stopped, searched, and sometimes detained. And if you think airports are immune, think again. Customs and border protection now operate facial recognition scanners in dozens of airports. Their systems log the faces of travelers, whether or not they're citizens. Critics argue this amounts to mass biometric surveillance, often with no clear limits on data storage, consent, or usage. The border, in other words, is no longer a line, it's a condition of permanent watchfulness, of needing to prove you belong, of being reminded constantly that some people are presumed innocent and others presumed foreign. And for people who live inside this invisible architecture, the psychological toll is immense. Trust erodes, fear grows. People stop traveling, they skip school, they avoid hospitals, they disappear into the shadows. Because when you live in a checkpoint nation, the question isn't just, are you safe? It's, are you seen as worthy of safety at all? Security always comes with a question, a hidden one. Security for whom? Because while some people see border agents as protectors, others see them as the first line of violence. While some pass freely through airports and checkpoints with no thought of delay, others know their name, their accent, their passport could land them in a holding cell or worse. Let's talk about the divide. In theory, a border protects everyone equally. In practice, it polices unevenly. Take asylum seekers. These are people fleeing violence from gangs, from war, from environmental collapse, from political persecution. International law says they have a right to ask for protection. But at US ports of entry, they're turned away, told there's no room, told to wait in dangerous camps on the other side, told to use an app, one that often fails. Some wait for months, some give up, some are kidnapped by cartels, some die. At the same time, a tourist from Europe can walk through with minimal questioning, their name triggers no alerts, their accent isn't seen as suspicious, their presence doesn't need to be justified. This is what inequality looks like, baked into the system. And for many migrants, especially Black and Indigenous ones, the inequality deepens. Haitian refugees in particular have faced horrific treatment at the US border. Whipped at riverbanks, held in squalid camps, denied basic dignity. Their skin, their language, their poverty, all coded as threats. And then there are the detention centers, places where children are held in cages, where families sleep on concrete floors under silver blankets, where people die from medical neglect, all under the banner of security. This is not an accident. This is not an isolated case. This is a design that decides who deserves empathy and who deserves containment. Even climate migrants, people who displaced by floods, droughts, and rising seas, are increasingly treated as criminals. As the climate crisis accelerates, millions will be forced to move. But border policies aren't adapting with compassion. They're fortifying. Barbed wire instead of shelter, camps instead of resettlement, detention instead of welcome. And all of it is justified by a single word, security. But again, we have to ask, security for whom? Because for many people, the ones running, the ones crossing, the ones surviving, the border doesn't feel like a shield, it feels more like a weapon. And as long as we only measure security by how many people we keep out, we'll never ask why they needed to leave in the first place. Let's pause here. We've spent a lot of time exploring the border as it exists, militarized, racialized, reinforced by profit and fear. But what would it look like to imagine something else? A world where security doesn't mean exclusion, where a nation's strength isn't measured by how high its walls are, but how deeply it cares. Let's look at some examples. Along the US-Mexico border, there are countless community groups doing what the government refuses to, offering shelter, food, medical care, and support, legal support to migrants. These are churches, non-profits, families, many of them once migrants themselves. They see security not as keeping people out, but as keeping people alive. They provide warmth in the desert. They leave water along migrant trails. They set up aid stations and medical tents. They teach language classes. They help file asylum paperwork. And they do it without badges, without guns, without drones. They do it because they believe safety should be mutual. Elsewhere, indigenous communities are reclaiming their role as protectors of land, not enforcing of lines. For many, the idea of a border is alien. It slices through ancestral territory. Instead, their vision of security is one of shared stewardship of water, soil, wildlife, and family ties that stretch across what governments call nations. And in Europe, some countries have experimented with humanitarian corridors, legal pathways for vulnerable people to enter safely, bypassing smugglers and bureaucratic traps. It's not perfect, but it's a reminder that policy is a choice. We can choose hospitality, we can choose dignity, we can choose welcome, but it requires a shift. It means asking not, how do we keep them out, but why are they coming, and what can we do to respond with care instead of cruelty. It means seeing migrants not as threats, but as people, as parents, as workers, as survivors, as future neighbors. And it means facing the truth that the greatest dangers we face, pandemics, inequality, ecological collapse, don't respect borders. They can't be stopped with a wall. They require cooperation. They require connection. The border as fortress has failed. It has cost lives, it has deepened fear, it has sold us the illusion of safety while leaving our humanity behind. So maybe the real security isn't in separation, maybe it's in solidarity. Take out a map, look at it, any map of the world. What do you see? Lines, crisscrossing the land, shaping continents into countries, countries into provinces, provinces into towns. A patchwork of names and borders. And shaded spaces, a visual order to the world. But here's the truth. Every line on that map is invented. Borders are not part of the Earth's crust. They are not rivers or mountains or forests. They are not natural facts. They are human choices, imagined lines given through belief, violence, and repetition. And yet, they've come to feel realer than rivers. We forget how many of these lines are. We forget how new many of these lines are. The passport as we know it, only about 100 years old. But modern nation state, just a few centuries. Some countries like South Sudan were born in the last decade. Others like Soviet Union vanished within a single lifetime. Even some of the most sacred borders were drawn with shocking carelessness. In 1884, European powers met at the Berlin Conference to carve Africa into colonial possessions. None of the African people living in those territories were present. Lines were drawn across entire cultures and landscapes, often with a ruler and a pen. Whole communities were split in two. Others were shoved together under foreign rule. It was quite literally a map of convenience, a border by committee. And the consequences still shape lives today. The India-Pakistan border, drawn hastily by the British in 1947 during decolonization, it led to one of the largest and bloodiest forced migrations in human history. Millions displaced, hundreds of thousands dead, neighbors turned enemies overnight, and yet we still treat these lines as if they were inevitable, as if they came down from the sky rather than from up from empire. But they are human inventions, which means they can be challenged, which means we have to ask, why did we draw them this way? Who benefited? Who suffered? Borders, after all, are not just lines. They are stories. Stories about who we are and who we are not. About where safety ends and danger begins. About who belongs inside and who we must keep out. And like all stories, borders can be rewritten. But first, we have to remember that we're the ones holding the pen. Every border begins with a question. Not where do you belong, but do you belong at all? It's one thing to draw a line on a map. It's another thing to tie that line to your identity, your rights, your value, your future. That's what citizenship does. It turns a place into a kind of moral inheritance. It says, you are a part of this, you belong here, and others do not. But citizenship isn't just about geography, it's also about luck. Where you're born, what passport you hold, what language you speak, what history your last name carries. And if you're born on the side of the line, you can vote, travel, get medical care, go to school. If you're born a few kilometers away across the border, you might get treated as a threat, a burden, a number. This isn't an accident. It's a system. A system that says some lives come pre-approved, others must be inspected. Some people are from here, others are always arriving. But who gets to decide? The truth is, many people live their whole lives as if they belong to a country. And yet the country never belongs to them. People born in nations that won't recognize them. People who pay taxes, raise families, care for communities, and are still called illegal. People who are stateless, who literally belong nowhere. And people in exile, who used to belong until they didn't. Then there's the other side. The people whose identity is the border. The flag wavers, the nation firsters. The ones who say, if you're not like me, you don't belong here. For them, the border isn't just a line. It's a mirror. One they stare into because they're afraid of what's outside. Or worse, afraid of what they might become if the line disappears. But here's the irony. Every person who believes they belong once, in some generation, a stranger. An immigrant. A traveller, a refugee, a child carried across the line. We all come from movement. And yet, somehow, we inherit a system that treats movement as a threat, stillness as virtue. So maybe the better question isn't who belongs, maybe it's what kind of world are we building? If it only works for people who never had to cross a line. Let's imagine something radical. Let's imagine a world with no borders, no checkpoints, no detention centers, no asylum queues, no visas, no patrols, no walls. A world where people move, not because they're desperate, but because they're allowed. A world where your rights aren't chained to your birthplace. Where the answer to "where are you from?" doesn't determine what you deserve. It sounds impossible, naive maybe, but is it? There was a time when women voting sounded impossible, when the end of slavery sounded impossible, when same-sex marriage sounded impossible, and yet there are philosophers, economists, and even some politicians today who argue that open borders would make the world not only more humane, but more prosperous, because the biggest barrier to opportunity is not talent, it's location. A person born in rural Niger has the same potential as someone born in Toronto or Sydney or Berlin, but the border between them is more than physical, it's economic, educational, and political. So studies suggest that lifting border restrictions could double global GDP. That's not charity, that's capacity, that's possibility. And contrary to popular fear, most migrants don't flood into other countries. They move closer to opportunity, yes, but also closer to family, to language, to safety. The vast majority never even leave their region. So what stops us from imagining a borderless world? Fear. Fear of crime, fear of lost jobs, fear of cultural change, fear of the unknown. But most of those fears aren't rooted in fact, they're rooted in narrative. And narratives can be rewritten. What if we said, you are welcome, not because you passed the test, but because you are human? What if we built systems of mutual aid, not mutual suspicion? What if we measured a country's strength by how many people it lifted up, not how many it locked out? Of course, there are real challenges, logistics, resources, integration. No system is without friction. But maybe the real test of a society isn't how well it guards its walls, but how boldly it dreams beyond them. So can we live without borders? Maybe not yet. But asking the question is the first step. Because until we can imagine the borderless world, we'll never be free to question what the border is doing to us now. It's often said that borders exist to protect jobs, to protect culture, to protect safety. That's the language we hear all the time, in speeches, in slogans, in debates. The idea that beyond the line there's danger and inside the line there's order, it's the story of the fortress. But fortresses aren't just defensive structures, they're built out of fear, and fear is powerful. It's visceral, it bypasses reason. It doesn't care about data, or context, or history. It just feels true. Which is why border politics are so often driven by not facts, but by emotion, fear of being overrun, fear of losing control, fear of the unfamiliar, fear that letting in others means letting something of yourself go. But here's what's strange. The places that are often most afraid of immigration are often the places with the least of it. Rural towns with few newcomers, isolated communities far from any port of entry, voters who've never crossed a border themselves. Fear doesn't come from contact, it comes from distance. And into that distance, we project worst-case scenarios, because fear is easier to sell than nuance. Think about the words we use. Flood, wave, surge, crisis. Language that makes people sound like a natural disaster. But people are not floods. They're not viruses. They're not threats. They're just people. Responding to wars, climate disasters, persecution, economic collapse. Or sometimes just chasing the same thing that we all want. A life with dignity. That doesn't mean borders don't serve a function. Of course they do. But when they become a symbol of purity or exclusion or fear, we have to ask, what exactly are we protecting and at what cost? Because fear builds fortresses, but it also builds prisons. And the longer we stay inside, the harder it is to remember what it is we were even afraid of in the first place. Let's be honest. This is not a simple issue. Borders are not all bad. They can help organize societies. They can offer stability in chaotic times. They can give a sense of place, a kind of collective belonging. And sometimes closing a border can even save lives during a pandemic, during conflicts, in moments of extreme vulnerability. So this isn't a call to pretend borders don't matter. But it is a call to ask what kind of meaning we give them. Because there's a difference between a border and a barrier, a line and a wall, a rule and a weapon. And maybe the deeper question isn't just about geography, it's about values. Where do we draw this line? Ethnically? Emotionally? Spiritually? Where do we draw the line between caution and cruelty? Between law and morality? Between what we're told is right and what feels just? Because sometimes we draw the line in a place that lets a child sleep safely at night. And sometimes we draw the line in a way that lets a child die on a beach, while we argue over whether their family followed the proper channels. That's not a policy failure. It's a moral one. We say borders protect us, but from what? From need? From complexity? From the fact that other people exist and want better lives too? Maybe what we're really trying to protect is our own illusion. That we can draw a line around our comfort, our own comfort, and call it justice. But the world isn't divided that cleanly. Suffering doesn't stop at the border, and neither does our responsibility. So yes, we may need lines, but we also need to ask again and again, what are these lines doing, and who are they leaving out? We started this episode with a question. Do borders protect us or divide us? The answer, perhaps, is yes, they do both. They can. They can be lifelines or barriers, safety nets or traps, symbols of sovereignty or scars from a past. It depends how we draw them, how we enforce them, how we imagine them. But maybe the deeper truth is, borders are not just lines on a map. They're lines in the mind. Lines that tell us who matters, who is ours, who is other. And we draw those lines all the time. Not just between countries, but between neighborhoods, between accents, between skin colors, between ways of being. Borders in that sense are not only physical, they're emotional, psychological, moral. And if we want a different world, we have to start with a different story. A story where empathy doesn't stop at the edge of a flag. A story where movement isn't shameful, but natural. A story where the question isn't how do we keep people out, but how do we let them in? With dignity, with care, and with courage. Because the challenges we face, climate change, conflict, inequality, displacement, they don't respect borders, and neither should compassion. The question is not whether we will live in a world of migration, we already do. The question is, will we meet that world with fear or with immigration? Maybe the real task is not to erase every line, but to stop pretending that the line is what defines us, and to stop asking what kind of a world could we build if we chose solidarity over suspicion, if we made the circle bigger, if we stopped seeing lines first and started seeing people. Because in the end, every line we draw is a choice. So, what do we want that choice to say about us? If you've stayed with me this far, thank you. Maybe you feel clearer now, maybe you feel more conflicted, that's okay. Borders were never meant to be simple, but the fact that you've listened, that you've let yourself question, already puts you beyond the line. Because asking these questions is the state of seeing differently. Next time we'll look at another place where the invisible rules shape our lives. And once again we'll ask, is this keeping us safe or keeping us small? Until then, stay curious, stay open, and keep walking the line.